This is the work of the Holy Spirit to say that not only has Jesus died, but he's died for you. It's not only that he's risen, but he's risen for you. He isn't ascended into heaven just in some sort of abstraction, but he's ascended into heaven for you to intercede for you.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller talking about his presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And that work of the Holy Spirit to press the events of the gospel, of the work of God, into our own hearts and into our own ears and into our own conscience comes through fantastically with those words for you.
You can meet and hear Pastor Brian Wolfmiller making the case for the for you of Christianity at our Fall Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. You'll find a list of speakers, topics, and registration information at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston. We talk a lot about the Reformation from one side, that is, what the reformers of the various stripes were doing in bringing reform to the church, be it Luther, Calvin, or Zwingli, the others. Another question remains, and that is, what was the Roman Catholic Church doing in response to the Reformation? Did they have a Reformation of their own? What did they do, and what did they see as the very heart of this thing that had been called the Reformation? And what was their thought on that? We're going to be talking about the Catholic Reformation. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Welcome back. Dr. Cameron McKenzie has been kind enough to join us now for seven parts. We're going into part eight of our nine-part series on the Reformation, talking about the Catholic response to the Reformation. He's professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of the Issues Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks, Todd. I'm glad to be back again. Thank you.
We're going to be talking about what you call the Catholic Reformation. Is that the same thing as the Counter-Reformation?
Well, kind of. The Counter-Reformation is a term that was used for a long time, especially in Protestant historiography, to describe Catholic efforts to meet Protestant attacks, change, modify their approach, crystallize their teaching and the like through the course of the 16th century. What more recent historians have come to realize is that not everything that the Roman Catholic Church did in the 16th century was simply a response to Protestants. Some of the things, for example, that we'll want to talk about, like the creation of new religious orders, including and especially the Jesuits, those things were happening independently of Protestantism. The Jesuits, for example, were first thought of by Ignatius of Loyola in order to do mission work, especially among the Muslims in the Holy Land. Well, it wasn't Protestantism that brought that idea to mind. But nonetheless, the Jesuits became an important part of the Catholic response to Protestantism. So it's a term, Catholic Reformation, that probably is a bit more expressive of all the phenomena that were going on in the Catholic Church in the 16th century that weren't entirely a response to Protestantism.
There's a lot of hyperbole on both sides, but, you know, Luther talks about overthrowing the Pope. He's obviously speaking there about theologically undoing the errors that were associated with the papacy. But you say that the Catholic Church thrived during the 16th century in a lot of places, didn't it?
Well, yes, in some places. Let's be clear about that. If you look, for example, at Spain during the 16th century, right at the end of the 15th century, a reform movement began in Spain, and it had as its consequences a clergy that were more pious, more disciplined, more dedicated, more educated than would be true in other parts of the Catholic world. Or again, if you look at some of the rulers, because among the Catholics as well as among the Protestants, it's the commitment of rulers that are either going to make or break the Catholic religion. And there you have people like Charles V, who could have embraced Protestantism, Lutheranism, But he decided not to. And on account of his deciding not to, made it more difficult for the people of his empire to become Protestant. And even though a lot of them did, nonetheless, there were places like Bavaria that stayed Catholic. So you had that phenomenon also. You've got these rulers who remain faithful to the old religion, the old church. And so the Catholic Church, though it has problems, especially at the top in terms of the papacy and other chief officers within the church as the 16th century opens, nonetheless, it has great residual strength even among the people, for many of whom the old religion was satisfactory. I mean, they're not all little Luthers concerned that they can't find certainty of salvation. No, they're doing their thing and reasonably content with it. People are joining the religious orders. They're going on their pilgrimages. They're purchasing masses for those who are souls in purgatory. Even the sale of indulgences is going strong prior to Luther's attack. And after his attack, there are some retreats from using indulgences as big fundraisers, but they continue to offer indulgences in order to encourage pious activities like prayers and other things that the church would take note of. So it's definitely a mixed picture when we look at the institutional church there at the beginning of the 16th century.
You had mentioned the papacy, and you also mentioned that the papacy right there at the beginning of the Reformation in Europe has been called by historians Renaissance papacy, as typified by probably the most famous Reformation Pope of them all, Reformation era Pope of them all, Leo X.
Yeah. The Renaissance is, of course, the name that we give to the culture and civilization produced first in Italy, home of the papacy, right? And then throughout the rest of Europe over the course of, 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. And one of the things we associate with that term Renaissance is a patronage of the arts and cultivation of the intellectual life. Well, by the end of the 15th century, we're getting popes who are sponsoring the creation of the Vatican Library, who are hiring as papal secretaries people like Lorenzo Valla, who was one of the first text critics, actually, and had ideas about improving the translation of the Bible, or who are patronizing some of the great artists of the day. Probably some of our audience are familiar with the old novel and movie Agony and the Ecstasy that shows the relationship between Pope Julius II and the great sculptor, painter, Michelangelo. So popes are sponsoring great works of art in this period. And in fact, Julius II not only hired Michelangelo to decorate the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, he also decided that what Rome needed was a brand new St. Peter's Cathedral. So he ordered the old one torn down and then brought in one of the great architects of the day, Bramante, to start planning and working on a new St. Peter's. Well, it took over 100 years for the new St. Peter's to be completed. It's not until the 17th century that it is. And then the great artist Bernini finishes it off and decorates the interior and the like. But the St. Peter's Cathedral that people see when they visit Rome, probably the greatest church in Christendom even to this day, was a result of that Renaissance Pope, Julius II's, decision to tear down the old cathedral. Now, popes like Julius II or his successor, Leo X, the great Medici Pope, his father was a great patron of the arts from the city of Florence, did know their art, did know their culture, were skilled and talented in many ways. But the Renaissance is their home, not the Reformation. They're not really good theologians. They don't appreciate the problems in Christian theology and Christian practice that so bothered men like Luther or Zwingli or any of the reformers. And so didn't really deal effectively with the challenges of the Reformation when those challenges came along. So, for example, Leo X, who's the Pope at the time, Luther posts the 95 Theses. When he hears what's going on, he is supposed to have said, well, this is just a squabble between the monks, Augustinians and Dominicans, for example. Well, that really wasn't it, but that was a way in which Leo X could deal with it. So those early popes during the Reformation period, starting with Leo and running at least through Clement VII, who's pope until 1534, simply did not deal very capably with the Reformation and the threat that it posed to the institutional church, the Catholic Church, and its position throughout Europe at that time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. It's part 8 of our 9-part series on the Reformation. We're talking about the Catholic Reformation. When we come back, we'll talk about friction between the Pope and the Emperor. Stay tuned.
The Church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
I'm Pastor Watson. Are you tired of entertainment and in need of the peace that passes human understanding? I invite you to Augsburg Lutheran Church in Shawnee, Kansas, to receive the gifts of Jesus. Augsburg is scriptural, traditional, historical, sacramental, and reverent. The Church of the Apostles, the Councils, and the Reformers wants to be your church family also. For more information, visit us at augsburglutheranchurch.org.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at AdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Evangelical and Catholic. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christians should operate fully in the public square, and that includes by engaging with the media.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And one of the things that they can do is encourage reporters to report things accurately and truthfully. They can express their opinions in letters to the editor and op-eds. And one of the things that's important is to just let people in the world know of the differences of opinion that are out there, that Christians don't share a lot of the secular thinking that is promulgated by the media. And so being bold and being able to stand up and simply speak truth in the public square, it's a powerful witness to others, and it's a service you can perform for your community and the country at large.
You can meet and hear Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christians engaging the news media at our Fall Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Monday, October the 30th. It's part eight of our nine-part series on the Reformation with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. We're talking about the Catholic Reformation, the Counter-Reformation. He's professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. This is the Reformation's story told in detail and in pictures, comes from the pen of a bona fide Reformation historian, so it gets the story right. It avoids, it avoids boring you, I can tell you that, because I have learned probably more in reading this book of Dr. McKenzie's than at least I recall learning about the Reformation when I went through the seminary. And that's saying something, because the education there was top-notch. You can find out more about this book, The Reformation, at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and order this book. Just splurge and order it as a gift to yourself as a way of celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. Dr. McKenzie, one of the things that we often don't focus on too much, because our eyes are often on Northern Europe and Germany, is the significant friction that existed at the time between the Pope and the Emperor, so much so that eventually we have imperial cannons aimed at the Pope's hiding place in the city of Rome.
Right, right. Well, it's a great story. One of the challenges that the Popes had, entirely independent of the Reformation, was a set of wars in the Italian peninsula. Those Italian wars began in the 1490s. They didn't really end until almost 1560. So they go over about two, three generations of fighting. And they involved not just territories within Italy, because Italy, even more than I would say Germany at this time, was divided into much smaller political subdivisions, which were in effect independent of one another. So you've got a divided peninsula, and it was possible for one part of Italy to be fighting against another part. But what made these wars particularly pernicious was the fact that outsiders invaded. The King of France started it all by invading in the 1490s. And the King of France had hereditary claims to southern Italy, the Kingdom of Naples. He also could make a claim to being the rightful Duke of Milan. So he had an interest that resulted in an invasion. But other powers in Europe weren't going to let France simply take over Italy. At that time, Italy was the most prosperous part of Europe, most densely populated. So it would be a good place to take over if you could, but the other rulers of Europe weren't going to permit the King of France to do it. So rulers from Spain, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, they're all interested, and they end up fighting one another in Italy. Now, if you're a territorial ruler in Italy, you're going to have to figure out what to do. Are you going to ally yourself with France? Are you going to ally yourself with Spain? What are you going to do? And one of those territorial rulers who had to make decisions like that was the Pope. Lots of folks don't remember that the Pope, up until 1870, was a territorial ruler in the Italian peninsula. At the time that we're talking about it, the Papal States, those territories that he ruled personally as Pope, stretched all across the Italian peninsula and up toward the north. I mean, it was a big chunk of territory. So he can't be indifferent to wars being fought right there on the peninsula. And so he too would have to make decisions. Well, in the mid-1520s, the war stopped and then it broke out again, the Pope at the time, who was, as I said, Clement VII, he thought that the King of France looked like a pretty good bet. And so he allied himself with the King of France over against the Holy Roman Emperor, Francis I versus Charles V. Well, in this phase of the Italian Wars, the Emperor won, and he won decisively. that meant that the Pope had chosen the wrong side, and therefore the Papal States were at least theoretically fair game for the emperor's army. Well, that army came all the way down to Rome and laid siege to the city of Rome. This is in 1527. And then in that effort to take the city, the commander of the imperial army was killed, so that when the city fell to the imperial army, it was no longer really an intact army. It was a number of army parts led by commanders of one part or another. So you had these band of hungry, marauding soldiers roaming around the city of Rome. This is known in the history books as the Sack of Rome. They are murdering, they are stealing, they are raping, they are burning. It's just a horrible episode. The Pope and his council narrowly escape into the Castle Sant'Angelo, which means the Castle of the Holy Angel. That building had been converted from a tomb for Emperor Hadrian into a medieval fortress. And there, they managed to hang on to their lives. The rioters are unable to take that fortress, but they're also stuck and can't get out of the fortress, can't get out of the city. And that condition lasts for months. It's not like over in a week or two. These soldiers are in charge of the city for months, and basically the Pope is their prisoner. Well, clearly, the Pope isn't going to be thinking all that much about what the Lutherans are doing in Germany. He isn't thinking too clearly about whether he's going to give a divorce to Henry VIII. He's thinking about how is he going to save his skin, as well as his position and maybe some of the wealth of the church in this horrible, horrible situation. Now, I'll just mention as kind of a postscript to the Sack of Rome, there are some historians who think that that episode in the history of the church was taken by many in the church as a sign of God's unhappiness with the church, that many of the abuses, financial and moral, that the church had tolerated among its highest members had perhaps brought down upon the institutional church the wrath of God, and that they'd better change their ways once that episode was over, or else they might face similar kinds of episodes in the future. So it was a very, very big deal, and it had a big effect upon the Reformation, even though it had nothing firsthand to do with the theology or the piety of medieval Catholicism.
We're talking about the Catholic Reformation. Dr. Cameron McKenzie of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is our guest. When we come back, he'll tell us the story of the Council of Trent.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
If you plan to buy one item commemorating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, I highly recommend the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. It's titled The Reformation. You'll want to display this richly illustrated book on your coffee table, in your church library, or anywhere you can easily flip through this informative and beautiful book. The Reformation is written by regular guest Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Learn more about The Reformation at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Welcome back. We're talking about the Catholic Reformation, part of our series on the Reformation. This is part 8. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. Dr. McKenzie, how do you even begin to tell the story about this church council on the part of the Roman Catholic Church in response to the Reformation that stretched over decades, was it? The Council of Trent.
Sure. Well, one of the decisions made by Clement's successor, Paul III, based upon the reality that the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation of different types, Lutheran, Reformed, etc., was going badly for the church, and therefore they had to change direction, they had to do something different, was to accede to demands of reformers that the church have a church council. Paul III made that decision. He would have wanted a council particularly to answer the theological or doctrinal attacks of the Protestants, to give a definitive once and for all answer to all those theological criticisms of the reformers. But there were others, such as Charles V, the emperor, who thought that a council needed to do more than that. It also needed to address the moral problems among the clergy, the institutional failings of the church, not just theological, but the way the church operated, the way people were appointed to church offices, for example. Now, Clement VII had resisted this notion because in an earlier period, 100 years earlier or so, church councils had really set themselves over against the papacy, claimed to be superior to the popes, and had tried to make life difficult for popes, to put it quite simply. And popes didn't want that to happen again. But Paul III realized that the church was going nowhere unless it took these steps to theologically to answer the Protestants. And if he's going to have a church council, the emperor would insist that that council also deal with these abuses in the institutional church. And finally, Paul III went ahead with this. He had to overcome opposition from people like the King of France, who was always at odds with the Holy Roman Emperor. But finally, that worked out as well. And so in 1545, an assembly met in the city of Trent. Now, Trent theoretically belonged to the Holy Roman Empire, but it was on the Italian side of the Alps and was Italian-speaking, so that Italian bishops could get there easily and the Pope could remain in touch with that council. Instead of it being on the other side of the Alps in, say, like German territory, where it really would have been technically and logistically impossible for popes to be on top of things. So it's in Trent. It opens in 1545. It's going to accomplish things on both levels, theology and practice, in sessions that really will always be dominated by the Italian bishops and will be presided over by cardinals who are the Pope's representatives. And this council will meet in three distinct sessions. The first one, 45 to 47, the second one, 51 to 52, and the last one, 62 to 63. So it's 18 years altogether, but only meeting for periods of months on three separate occasions. But it does what it needed to do. It answered the Protestant theological critique, and it adopted measures to eliminate the abuses of the sort that I was talking about before. So it laid the groundwork, theologically and practically, for the Catholic Church in the early modern period. What Trent laid out really came to define Catholicism up until the middle of the 20th century, the 1960s, and the Second Vatican Council, But of course, that's still another story. Who knows, maybe even another book. But at any rate, that's the Council of Trent.
This council, I just want to talk a little bit about its findings, but
sure.
But more generally, we talk about Tridentine. That's a reference to Trent. Tridentine, right. Roman Catholicism, that what you just mentioned there, that it had a tendency to kind of ossify Roman Catholicism for centuries after this as a reaction to the Reformation, taking what we used to call medieval Roman Catholicism and saying, yep, that's what we're going to be. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Almost. There's lots of variety in medieval Catholicism. If you think about it, we're prior to the printing press. So there's much less ability, for example, to insist that every Catholic know and memorize the same doctrinal truths. There's quite a little variety in Catholicism prior to the Council of Trent. But issues that have been raised by the Protestants are now settled at the Council of Trent. A doctrine is determined, and that doctrine can be put into print. All priests can be educated to know and memorize that doctrine, and they in turn can instruct their members. So catechisms that of the sort that Luther had produced for his people, the Catholic Church will produce at the time of the Council of Trent and thereafter, so that kind of more an imitation of Protestantism than an imitation of the medieval church, they will insist that to be a Catholic, you must hold to these doctrines. And those doctrines are in large part defined over against Protestantism. So, for example, authority in the church. Protestants of all stripes said the Bible and the Bible alone. Council of Trent said, in our church, it's the Bible plus unwritten traditions handed down from the apostles and Christ through the bishops to the present. Well, that's a kind of two sources then for doctrine and practice instead of just one. That becomes the official position, and that makes it into these instructional manuals, catechisms, and the like that then define Catholicism. Now, there are practical issues, too, in which the Council of Trent kind of dug in its heels. One was the use of Latin. There's nothing in Christianity which would insist that you have to use as your language of worship a language that only few understand. But the Council of Trent basically said, if Latin was good enough for our ancestors, it's good enough for us. And so in early modern Catholicism, up until Vatican II, that was the language of worship all over the Catholic world. Likewise, the liturgy of the Mass. In the Middle Ages, you had some variety, but Council of Trent said, no, we're going to have one uniform Mass, turned over its preparation to the papacy. That was soon completed, and so you had a uniform liturgy for Catholics all around the world, and that characterized early modern Catholicism. Likewise, celibacy of the clergy. That was something that wasn't up for grabs prior to Trent, but it had a history that you could see in the story of Catholicism, but now it became mandatory, and so that became characteristic of early modern Catholicism. There are a host of other issues that Council of Trent made determinative for Catholicism for centuries. And as I say, much of it was in response to what Protestants were saying and doing. And the Council of Trent said, no, we're not going that direction. We are something different. We are followers of the Pope, Roman Catholics. We're not Protestants.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. More on the Catholic Reformation after this.
When we say Lutheran, we mean Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
40 years greatly blessed is this year's theme at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a special 40th anniversary tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page. Or call me, Dr. Jay Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. Starting October 1st, this twofold mission becomes even more pronounced. During October, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their ministry of the month, the Concordia Historical Institute. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church.
Trinity Orchard Farm is settled between two rivers, showing the way to the water of life. For worship that is reverent, relevant, and refreshing like pure water, or for excellent education in a unique setting, check out our church and school. We're just 5 miles north of Highway 370 on Highway 94 in St. Charles County. Visit us on the web at trinityorchardfarm.com. That's trinityorchardfarm.com. Our phone number is 636-250-3350.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our series on the Reformation continues with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. We're talking about the Catholic Reformation, part 9 of that series, dealing with how the Catholics responded to the Reformation. Now, we spoke a little bit before about the Council of Trent. It had a lot to respond to, after all. It's not like the Lutherans only brought one idea to the table. They had documents and documents and back and forth. So the Council of Trent had a mighty task in responding not only to Lutheranism, but to Protestantism in general. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. McKenzie on that subject. He's professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. The key, probably most impactful finding of the Council of Trent, Dr. McKenzie, had to do with the doctrine of justification by grace through faith for Christ's sake alone. And in particular, Trent condemned that through faith alone part in great detail. They anathematized those who held and taught these things. And I've often said that Trent did not misunderstand. This was not a big misunderstanding. Trent understood the Lutheran position on justification when they condemned that doctrine. Do you agree?
I do agree with that. In fact, I've read, though I've never checked this out personally, that it's Luther and Lutheranism that is the principal form of Protestantism that the Council of Trent is aware of and consistently condemns. Not Zwinglianism, not Calvinism, but Lutheranism. And that clearly is the case on the doctrine of justification. Now, Trent attempts to avoid the extreme of Pelagianism. So it affirms that justification is by grace alone. But on the other hand, it also rejects the notion of justification by faith alone. Faith is fine as the beginning of justification, but faith is always formed by love, and that means that in the process of justification, there are always works that a faithful Christian does that then make God's judgment upon that Christian a consequence not only of his being in a state of grace, but also of his cooperating with grace to do good works that are pleasing to God. And this is true throughout the 16th century, and one of the reasons that I like to study it is that theologians and churches indicate not only what they stand for, but also what they stand against. It was pretty much a consensus that true Christianity was something that you could state as propositions of truth that were either themselves true or false. And certainly the Council of Trent does that. And as you said, in its canons, it anathematizes positions that are counter to the ones that they are articulating. And on this question, the question of justification, it condemns very explicitly the Lutheran position of justification by faith in our Lord Jesus Christ alone. So, yeah, good point.
A couple more quick questions for you.
Sure.
Were there any Lutherans, at least in attendance at the Council of Trent or any of its sessions?
Yeah, that's a really neat story. I'm not sure they thought it was so neat at the time, but it is neat to read about today. Right after the Schmalkald War, which is right after the death of Luther, which Charles V won and the Lutherans lost, the Council of Trent, which had been in a hiatus, wasn't meeting, was summoned back into existence by the Pope, and his name escapes me at the moment. And Charles V let it be known that he wanted representatives from the empire there. They hadn't been particularly active or present in the first sessions, and now they came, and that meant the prince, archbishops, the electors of Mainz, Cologne, and Trier. But he also insisted that some representatives from Lutheran territories also went. So this is at end of 1551. You get delegates from Württemberg, and the one really big name who Lutheran theologian who was there was Johannes Brentz, who was an old ally of Luther's on the real presence argument with Zwingli. Another famous individual who made it was Johannes Marbach, and he would become very important in Lutheranizing the city of Strasbourg. Even Melanchthon was on his way to the Council of Trent, but was waiting for final permission from his elector to actually go. He was in Nuremberg, and he was planning to go. Well, they're there for a matter of weeks, a few months. They actually have a meeting with the delegates to the Council of Trent, and the Lutherans basically are insisting that the council start over, that it reject papal authority, that the presiding officer not be a representative of the Pope, that the Lutheran delegates get to vote just like the bishops of the Catholic Church, none of which is going to fly. And in point of fact, the conversations end when the emperor finds himself in a war again with Lutheran princes, and this time the Lutheran princes prevail, and Charles is driven back out of his imperial territories. The Council of Trent adjourns, and Lutherans go home, and it's not for another decade. The Council of Trent doesn't meet for another decade, and when it finally meets in its third period, the Lutherans don't come back. But there is that short period of time in which you have Lutherans at the Council of Trent.
From our perspective, Dr. McKenzie, looking back on the Council of Trent, what improvements followed that council in Roman Catholicism?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the biggest practical step, which I would also call an improvement in early modern Catholicism, had to do with the office of bishop. In the Middle Ages, bishops were often appointed to a diocese for the sake of the income while they served in church or state in a totally different capacity. So you had Italian cardinals appointed, for example, to English bishoprics, not because they were going to come to England and run the Diocese of Winchester, for example, but because they were going to act in the interests of the King of England in Italy at the court of the Pope or some other Italian spot. Well, the Council of Trent took steps to bring such arrangements to an end and ruled that a bishop was supposed to reside in his diocese and really act as a supervisor of the clergy and as a pastor to the people. This, of course, was a big change for a lot of people, and it wasn't implemented immediately. There were too many vested interests in the old system. But there were a few right away who actually embraced the new role, and they became important models for bishops in succeeding centuries. So that today, I mean, what do we think of when we think of a bishop of a place? Well, we think of somebody who's in that place, chief administrator of the church, but also acting pastorally toward his people. In the 16th century, Carlos Borromeo was a good example of this. He was the nephew of a pope and had received his Archbishopric of Milan as kind of a reward for papal service, but he got religion, so to speak, and requested and received permission to actually become the Archbishop of Milan. And there he took steps to educate the priests, to discipline clergy who did not follow the rules for the way clergy lived. He helped to organize relief of the poor and the sick during times of emergency. In short, he became a real bishop in the Catholic Church instead of just an ecclesiastical bureaucrat. And I would say that probably was the most important. Among things that these new bishops now who stayed in their diocese were supposed to do was to educate the clergy. And so we see the beginnings of what we might call seminary education, in which men were recruited for the priesthood, trained in Catholic doctrine, but then also had their character trained, that they were shown what it means to live like a pious priest instead of just doing whatever they wanted to and collecting the salary. So, again, it didn't happen all at once, but the Council of Trent laid down these regulations that the church gradually adopted, and so changed the character, especially of the clergy in the Roman Catholic Church.
Did we see an improvement in the men who occupied the office of the papacy?
Oh, for sure, right. As the 16th century progresses, the men who are chosen for the papacy, though they're all Italians, nonetheless, their family connections are just one part of their qualifications. Another part was their commitment to the institutional church. And among other things, that would mean implementing the decisions of the Council of Trent. And so, for example, one of the things that Trent had approved was the use of the Latin Vulgate for as their official version. But everybody knew that the Vulgate, as available in print and in manuscript, was an imperfect version of the Vulgate that Jerome and his company had produced at the beginning of the Middle Ages. Well, Pope Sixtus V undertook a review and correction of the existing Vulgates to put into print as a standard then for the church to use everywhere. Now, Sixtus was something of a character, though really quite a good administrator. He helped to reorganize the church to make it more efficient in the early modern period. But his version of the Vulgate was not as good as he thought it was. And so even though he had ordered that it should never, ever after that be changed, one of his immediate successors, Clement, and I want to say Clement the Eighth, undertook to review it and to produce an even better version of the Vulgate. And that became the standard Vulgate over the next several centuries, a standard Bible then for the Catholic Church. So it's popes like that who put their mark on the Catholic Church and really demonstrate a much improved version of the papacy, not from the standpoint of doctrine. I don't want to pretend that that happened or that it's unimportant, but at least from the standpoint of the character of the men who held that office.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest, part 8 of our 9-part series on the Reformation. Today, the Catholic Reformation. We'll talk about the Roman Inquisition, an attempt to root out heresy in Italy, after this. Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues, Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues, Etc. Write scholarship in the memo line and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Relevant worship isn't about trying to look and act like the rest of the world to appeal to the culture around us, but relevant worship is about Christ. Hope Lutheran Church of Birmingham brings you truly relevant worship, where sinners gather to hear God's word and receive his gifts of forgiveness and peace. Visit us online at hopebham.org. That's hopebham.org. Or give us a call at 205-956-1930. We'll see you Sunday.
Continuing education for the Confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
If you have a middle school-aged child or grandchild in the St. Louis Metro East, encourage them to attend an open house from 1 to 3 in the afternoon on Sunday, November the 5th at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. You can meet faculty, staff, administration, students, and parents. Learn more by calling 618-656-0043 or visit melhs.org. Open house, 1 to 3 Sunday afternoon, November the 5th at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC, and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. ReformationGear.com, the new Martin Luther plush figure, ReformationGear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Dr. Cameron McKenzie, author of the Issues Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation, is our guest. We often hear about inquisitions with respect to this time, but there was one, the Roman Inquisition, as opposed to the Spanish Inquisition. The Roman Inquisition, an attempt here to root out heresy in the Italian peninsula. Talk about that one.
Yeah, right. Well, the idea of a special church court known as the Inquisition goes back into the Middle Ages. It had developed as something additional to the ordinary ecclesiastical court systems, which were basically, the ordinary system was basically under the control of the bishops. But the Inquisition could range more widely over a territory, over several dioceses, instead of being just organized around one, and could be given a special purpose by the church, for example, to root out heresy if it was particularly prevalent in a special area. Well, the Spanish had rediscovered this court at the end of the Middle Ages. An inquisitorial court had been established for Spain because of special problems in Spain, and that was conversions, and I put that in quotation marks, of two important minorities that lived in Spain, namely Muslims, because, of course, the peninsula had been ruled by Muslims for many centuries, and many of them still live there, and then also Jews. Spain had been a place where significant numbers of Jews had settled through the centuries, too. But now they were all supposed to convert. Well, the Inquisition was developed there in order to root out false conversions. Not a particularly appealing process, but the church was looking for something efficient to use for what they considered a serious problem. Well, in the 16th century, during the papacy of Paul III, the Roman Inquisition was developed. And this was a special court initially for Roman environs that went after particularly egregious cases of false doctrine or immoral life or whatever might be particularly troublesome. And Paul III turned this over to a handful of high church leaders, one of whom was a fellow by the name of Caraffa. His family, if I'm remembering correctly, came from southern Italy, Naples. But anyway, Cardinal Caraffa really threw himself into the Inquisition. And when later he became Pope, Paul IV, he decided to use the Inquisition rather than the Council of Trent as his instrument for reforming the church. And that meant going after all kinds of offenders and punishing them severely. Now, one of the things that made the Inquisition an efficient form of judiciary was the fact that it worked on a basis of, it could be anonymous accusations. It did use torture to get confessions. And then it could mete out very serious penalties. And indeed, the Inquisition could turn people over to the secular authorities for being executed. Well, it was used by Caraffa and some of his successors in the territories that Rome controlled directly. But then, if a Catholic ruler wanted it, it could also be used in a Catholic territory or country. And so it was looked upon as a pretty efficient ecclesiastical court system that went after moral deviants, false conversions, and also heretics. Protestants, of course, hated it, and later Protestant historians kind of wrote it up as the epitome of tyranny. But really, in terms of the 16th century, its great advantage wasn't so much the fact that it was perverse, but because it was effective. And that's why people didn't like it, because it did a good job of what it was trying to do.
I think to understand that, we do have to return to one subject, and that is that we cannot imagine in an age of religious freedom there being something like an Inquisition.
Right, right.
But this is not, and so we look back on it with 21st century and American eyes, mm-hmm. and cannot understand how they could have even conceived of such an idea. Just take us, if you would, briefly, as you alluded to before, the reasoning here from their perspective of, you know, the state and the church ought to work together to eradicate false teaching and to see to it that citizens are not just good citizens, but good sons and daughters of the church.
Absolutely. And as we think about that, we have to realize it characterizes not only Catholic countries and the Catholic Church, but also Protestant countries and Protestant churches, including the Lutheran Church. In every one of these European territories or states or countries, there was an established church, and it was the view both of the church leaders and of the government officials that this was the true church. And so measures were taken both to educate the people in the precepts of that church, through catechisms, hymnals, and so forth, but then also legal steps to make sure that heretics didn't arise or representatives of false religions come in. And so do two things. First of all, and most obviously, if you think your form of Christianity is the correct one, one problem of deviant points of view, either from outside or inside the country, is that they're going to be teaching something that can lead people to hell. And if you take your religion seriously, and as a state official, you take it seriously, that's kind of the last thing that you want, that you'll be sending people to hell by permitting a false teacher to preach and teach your people. The other thing that was pretty commonly held was the notion that a community with more than one religion was going to be a divided community, And of course, they experience that. In places like France, I think we talked about that the other day, you had these terrible wars of religion. And you had Huguenots, Protestants versus French Catholics. And didn't matter whether they were related or neighbors, their religion, they spoke the same language, their religion divided them. And it made it almost impossible for there to be peace and harmony in a particular place. So that would be a second reason why you'd want to make sure as much as possible that only one religion prevailed in your community or even in your country. The alternative was not everybody doing his own thing, but the alternative was everybody mad at one another and being willing to fight and kill in the name of religion. So for those two reasons, you don't want people to go to hell, and you need religion as kind of a social glue. In early modern Europe, really the notion of religious liberty was held by very, very few people, and really had, in a couple of places, it was the default position. They couldn't get religious harmony or unity, but nonetheless, it was hardly anybody's ideal solution.
It's our series on the Reformation. Today, we're talking about the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest, professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. God continues to call faithful church workers to serve his word and serve God's people. If you are interested, and if you've ever considered the vocation of either pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at 1-800-481-2155. Or visit ctsfw.edu. Forming servants in Jesus Christ to teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. When we come back, did the Roman Inquisition work?
You can celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation by listening to a special Reformation service on Tuesday evening, October 31st, live from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will be preaching. Join us for a live Reformation service Tuesday night, Reformation Day, 6:30 Central, 7:30 Eastern, 5:30 Mountain, and 4:30 Pacific at issuesetc.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app.
500 years ago, Martin Luther published 95 Theses and changed the world as we know it. Learn more about the Reformation Luther sparked and how and why Lutherans are celebrating its 500th anniversary when you read the October issue of the Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe to print and digital editions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's flagship magazine. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Sacramental. Historical. Liturgical. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Monday. We're continuing our series on the Reformation today, the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Dr. Cameron McKenzie, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation, is our guest. Before the break, Dr. McKenzie, you were talking about the Roman Inquisition, that attempt to root out heresy from the Italian peninsula. And you said it was efficient. You said that several times. So did it work?
I think it did work. Just as censorship worked, that too was a phenomenon of early modern Europe, Protestant and Catholic. It wasn't perfect, but it did make it more difficult for books deemed dangerous to circulate easily among the population. Sometimes historians use the word confessionalization to describe the process that's occurring all over Europe in the late Reformation period, and that's using the power of the state to effect religious unity among the people in a particular territory, and so identify the religion with the country. So that, you know, if you lived in Saxony, you were Lutheran. If you lived in Paris, you were Catholic. If you lived in London, you were Anglican. And it kind of wove that religious consciousness into the lives of the people in a particular place. So that even to this day, if you know that somebody's from Sweden, if they're any religion, they're probably Lutheran, nominal Lutherans probably. But the process did work. I mean, that's why we have this kind of identification between ethnicity and certain Christian denominations.
What about the general commitment to the church and to Catholicism after the Council of Trent?
Well, again, things don't change all at once, but they do change gradually, so that in the Catholic Church, there is a greater sense of what it means to be Catholic. The doctrinal issues have been settled. And so if you're going to be a Catholic, these are the things that you're going to believe. But then also the devotional practices have also been settled. The doctrine of transubstantiation and the Mass is now a settled question. And so even new forms of piety will arise, but there'll be new forms of piety that revolve around the truths that have been articulated by the Council of Trent and church authorities in this Reformation period. So in medieval Europe, to be a Catholic really just meant to be a Christian, and to be a Christian meant that you were a European of some sort. It wasn't really doctrinal, it wasn't theological, but that's much more the case in early modern Catholicism, as indeed in Protestantism, than had been true before. To be a Catholic meant to master certain truths, to live a certain way, to practice a certain piety, much more, I'll say strictly, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, but much more definitively than had been true prior to the Reformation.
Talk about the founding of the Jesuits, this order that has proven to be so profoundly influential worldwide for Roman Catholicism.
Sure. One of the standards you can use through history as to whether the church, the Catholic Church, is in good shape or not, is whether Catholic people are supporting joining religious orders. It's only when the church is thriving are people in large numbers giving themselves over to permanent service to the church by taking these vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Well, the 16th century proved to be a fertile period for the religious life. And there were several new orders that were established in the 16th century, and old orders were reformed and revived. But among them all, probably the most noteworthy is the Society of Jesus, the members of which are called Jesuits, and the founder of which was a Spanish nobleman by the name of Ignatius of Loyola. He is one of the big names in the story of the church in the 16th century, probably deserves as much attention as almost anybody else that we talk about. He was not a profound theologian, but he was a masterful leader and developed ideas regarding church service and Catholic piety that survived a long, long time. As I said, he was a Spanish nobleman, not a powerful figure by any means. As a young man, he served under a much more important Spanish nobleman. And following him, he got involved in fighting against France, kind of a traditional enemy of Spain. And in that fight, he displayed great bravery, but also was hit by a cannonball. It shattered one leg and damaged the other as well. It did not cost him his life, but it cost him his career. And he had to experience a very long convalescence. And in that convalescence, he read religious literature, the life of Christ, lives of the saints, and experienced a conversion, a commitment, not to the Protestant gospel or something like that, but a renewed commitment to the church and a life of service to the church. With that, he went off and spent some time in a cave as a hermit, religious hermit, experiencing all kinds of temptations, visions, disciplining himself, challenges, and the like. But at the end of that, he was really a changed person. He went back to school, got a good theological education, including several years at the University of Paris. And there he shared some of his thinking with companions, gathered a small group around him, and in the 1530s, together, they formed a new religious society, the Society of Jesus. Pope Paul III, again, a few years later, I think it was 1540, recognized the group as an authentic form of the religious life. Now, what Ignatius did with this group was different from traditional religious orders. When you belonged to it, you were committing yourself to service in the church. He wanted his men to be missionaries, particularly to Muslim lands and the Eastern Mediterranean. That didn't work out because of war and the like. So he added a fourth vow to the Jesuits. The traditional vows are poverty, chastity, and obedience. The fourth vow was a vow of obedience to the Pope, that a Jesuit would go wherever the Pope wanted him to go for the sake of salvation of souls. Jesuits were not going to be monks and live apart in a behind walls, a life of prayer and worship. They weren't even going to be mendicants who went around begging but still lived in community and had a certain uniform and the like. They did not pledge to live in community, although many of them did. They did not have a specific uniform. They didn't have a specific place, but Ignatius wanted them to be available for service to the church in the world. Missionaries were some of the first Jesuits, people like Francis Xavier, who took the Catholic religion to India, Japan, even had plans for China. I think maybe he got to China, but nonetheless, very, very far away. Others were teachers. Jesuits started Catholic schools. They made commitments to having the best schools, and indeed even Protestants in Europe recognized them as great educators, and some families sent their kids to these schools. They also function as theologians. One of the great theologians of the late 16th century, Robert Bellarmine, who crossed swords with Chemnitz, but not just Lutherans, with Reformed and Anglicans as well. He was a Jesuit. They had Jesuits who were at some of the late sessions of the Council of Trent. They also served as advisors and father confessors to some of the rulers, Catholic rulers in Europe at the time. The Holy Roman Emperor, the Dukes of Bavaria, some of the more important Catholic politicians were also Jesuits. And finally, I might just add that Ignatius of Loyola wrote one classical work expressing of Catholic piety called the Spiritual Exercises. It is a work of devotion. It's not a work of theology or dogma, in which he has many different devotional exercises in which someone engages his entire person in reflecting upon the scriptures or lives of the saints, praying to God, uses his imagination. So, for example, when talking about the crucifixion, Ignatius will say, just imagine what you were, if you were there and you rubbed your hand over the cross. Imagine what the slivers would feel like. Smell the air. Smell the sweat of the prisoners. Put yourself into these scenes emotionally as well as intellectually, and then he'll urge people to have a conversation with Christ or the Virgin Mary or some other saint so that you are really engaging your whole person in these spiritual exercises with the goal that at the end of these exercises, you'll be more closely united to God in your will. You will want the things of God. Now, it's all still very works righteousness. You do these things because you are concerned about your soul's salvation. But it's also very interesting and different from what we normally think of as a devotional or Christian life. So Ignatius and his Jesuits are a really important and long-lasting contribution of the Counter-Reformation to Catholic piety and Catholic life, even to this point.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for October, The Reformation. Next time, we're going to be talking with Dr. McKenzie about the late Reformation. Dr. McKenzie, thanks for your time.
Thank you again for having me. It's been great.
When we come back from the break, we're going to go through some of your listener comments from the Issues, Etc. listener comment line. That number you can use anytime, 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 618-223-8382, 618-223-8382. Responding to some of your comments after this.
I think every man, every Christian should consider, at least, the possibility of God calling him into the holy ministry.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fekencher of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Because that's the way that God has designed for faith in Christ Jesus to be spread, for the gift of eternal life that Christ Jesus earned by his death and resurrection to be shared with people. By the washing of baptism for infants and for adults, for the instruction, the proclamation of the word that happens on a nonstop basis in God's kingdom, God uses people, he uses men to be those proclaimers, to be those men who share the sacraments.
If you've ever considered becoming a pastor, contact Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their phone number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes. Dedicated customer service and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd. What have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC Rucam. But no matter how you say it, Ad Crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADC, RUCEM.com.